Hello, my name is Casey Self. I work at Arizona State University, and I've been involved with academic advising for about 24 years. And we at the Phoenix Conference for NACADA in 2018, our theme is around the stories of academic advisors and our stories of students. And as part of the conference theme, we're using the StoryCorps app to record stories from individuals to talk a little bit about their experience with academic advising. And today I have the pleasure of being with Dr. Charlie Nutt, who is the executive director for NACADA. And it is my pleasure to spend some time with him, learning a little bit more about him and his experience with academic advising. It is Monday, April 9th, 2018. We are downtown Chicago at the Renaissance, where Charlie and I have just participated in the conference for the Higher Learning Commission. So, Charlie, welcome, and thank you very much for spending some time with me. So, please introduce yourself, a little bit about your role, and we'll go from there.
Okay. I'm Charlie Nutt, and I'm Executive Director of NACADA, as well as Assistant Professor at Kansas State University, teaching in the graduate programs for college student personnel and our master's and graduate certificate in academic advising.
Great.
And I've been with NACADA now for 17 years, which doesn't feel like it should be possible, but I am, so.
Great. So Charlie, how did you get started in academic advising?
I got started back in 1986. I took a job teaching a one-year temporary English position at the community college that I graduated from as an undergraduate student. It was Brunswick College back then. And was a faculty member. We had an all-faculty model of advising. And so my first experience with advising was being told the day before students were going to arrive that, oh, by the way, we forgot to tell you, you're going to be advising a group of students, and they'll be here tomorrow. You might want to look at their folders. And that was my total experience and my first-time knowledge of advising and what I was supposed to be doing, which I had no idea what that was.
So as you continue there at Brunswick Community mm-hmm. College, talk a little bit about the roles that you had and your continued involvement advising there at Brunswick.
I came in with 86, and they had just had their accreditation visit a few years later. And advising was one of those areas that the accrediting body gave the institution several recommendations about. That it was not being done well, and we had a brand new president, and she, for some reason, thought I could fix advising, so she said for me to fix it. And
did she know what she meant?
No, she had no idea what she meant.
Did you know what she meant?
I had no idea what she meant. And so I first thing I went to was a retention conference that was in New York City, and heard Dr. Betty Siegel, who was then president at Kennesaw State University in Georgia. She was the keynote speaker, and I went up to her afterwards and said, you know, I'm in Georgia, you're in Georgia, you've talked about advising and how great it is at Kennesaw, I'd like to come talk to someone. And she recommended that I go see Dr. Nancy King, who was the assistant vice president for student affairs at the time. And Nancy tells the story that Betty probably told 10,000 people a year to go see her, and I was the only person that showed up on her doorstep and wouldn't leave until she told me everything I needed to know. And her final thing to get me out of her office was, you need to get involved with NACADA. So that's how I began. And took a group of 8 faculty members to the first NACADA region meeting I'd ever been to in Birmingham, Alabama. And we were so ignorant about what we were going to and what we were arriving to that we walked in asking where the NACADA meeting was, because we didn't even know that the name was NACADA. And the next year, the conference was in Mississippi, and then it was supposed to be in Georgia. And someone said, who's going to host it in Georgia? And Nancy King said, Charlie will. And so I got involved by doing the 1993 Region 4 conference in Savannah, Georgia. So that was the beginning of my history with NACADA.
Oh, that's outstanding. You mentioned Nancy King, and as we both know, she's an icon in Nakata, and you explained how you got to know her, but can you tell me a little bit about your relationship over the years and how you've learned from her and she's learned from you? And
you know, one of the things I think that makes Nakata the association it is the fact that we're an association that we don't just become colleagues, we become friends. You know, you and I are an example. Mm-hmm. We've been knowing each other since 1997, and you know, one of my best friends, and Nancy is the same way. I've known her since 1992, and just been, she's been a huge mentor to me in so many ways, but primarily in getting me more involved in Nakata and getting connected within that.
Great.
But we're still very, very good friends, and I think that's really what the story behind Nakata is, or the friendships that we build within the association that makes us very different, I think, from so many other associations.
I agree. So how long were you at Brunswick, and then could talk a little bit about the transition to the executive office?
I was at Brunswick from 1986 until 2002, and had during that time got my doctorate and was vice president for student development services. And the goal at that time, my goal was to become a college president. And I interviewed for several presidencies and got offered a couple. And the more I interviewed and the more I went to campuses, the more I realized I didn't really want to be a college president. It was too far removed from students, and that was not something I wanted to do. I wanted to always have a connection with students. And the more presidents I talked to and the more I interviewed, it became much more focused on the politics and the fundraising, and that just wasn't something I wanted to really do. And in 2001, the great 9/11 hit, as we know, across the country with the airplanes and the Twin Towers. And our conference was in Ottawa that year. And so at the Ottawa conference, they announced that they were creating a new position called the Associate Director for the association. Bobby Flaherty had been the Executive Director since the Executive Office opened in 1990. And so this was a brand new position. It was the first position being brought into the executive office for someone who had academic advising background and content piece. And I remember sitting at the board meeting and she announced this new job and we're going to do the search, and sitting next to Nancy King, and I looked at Nancy and said, I want that job. And so I applied for it and started in March of 2002.
Wow. So talk a little bit about the responsibilities you've had as executive director of Nakata.
As associate director initially, it was to really bring in the content piece. The association had just gone through a pretty major association restructuring. We laughed that Nancy King was the last president that dealt with the old structure. And under the old structure, we had 75 board members, so it was like herding cats. And most people who were in leadership within the association felt like they had two jobs. They had the full-time job with their campus, and then they had a Nakata full-time job, because the executive office really only did the management of conferences and the financial. So anything dealing with content, members had to do. So for example, a monograph that we would publish would take up to 5 to 6 years to get published, because you're dealing with volunteers to do all of that. And with the restructuring, the idea was for the board to focus on strategic planning and financial, for the council to oversee the various divisions, but for the members to come up with, this is where we want to go, this is what we want to do, but the executive office then be the implementers. And so to do that, we had to bring in content people. So Marsha Miller came about, I think, She says she's 2 weeks older than I am, so she came 2 weeks before I did. And we were the first two content people. And at that time was when we began producing the content for the association within the executive office. The members have still driven the content, still been the authors, still been the editors, but instead of them also trying to do all the background work and all the bidding of publication and getting them printed and all of that, we took that on in the executive office. And so we've added, since Marsha and I, we now have Jennifer Jocelyn, who's a total content person, Lee Cunningham, who's a total content person, Dawn Krause, who's working totally with content. And so it gives the opportunity for our members to really say, this is what we need. A great example of the core competencies that the association has just developed through the Professional Development Committee. That would have taken probably 5 to 6 years under the old structure. And with having Lee as the executive office liaison to the Professional Development Committee, that could move forward, and we were able to do that in 2 years. And so it's really allowing the members to guide where the association goes and the executive office to do the implementation and the development and contracting and all of that, so members can really focus on where we want the association to be and have the executive office do all the background work. I kind of describe it that we've got just under 14,000 members. Got office staff of 19 full-time staff, lots of student workers, grad students, and we basically do everything that a campus does. We recruit students, we retain them, we register them, we sell them their books, we design their courses, and so with a staff of 19, we basically do everything a college does for its students, we do for our members.
Outstanding. Well, you know, having been part of the leadership structure for several years, I completely agree with how the association, you know, depends on the members, because, you know, the members all have full-time jobs at some institution that they're working at, but it gives them an opportunity to really develop and be participate in the process of creating new knowledge. And I think that's worked really well, and especially under your leadership. You know, one of the significant things that I think has happened in the last few years, and I had the pleasure of being part of this, was the fact that academic advising became kind of an international phenomenon. And I know that, you know, like in the UK, they call it personal tutoring, and there I'm sure there are others. But talk a little bit about your experience in the internationalization of NACADA.
Okay. Back when Joanne Huber was president of NACADA, and I think that was maybe 2006, possibly, her daughter was graduating from high school, and she got an invitation to come speak at a personal tutoring conference in the United Kingdom, in York, England, and she couldn't go, and so they asked me if I would go. And I had no idea what personal tutoring was. In fact, I even said to the person that called me, you know, we're an academic advising association. We don't deal with student tutoring. And they had to very quickly make me aware of that's what it was in the UK. And I went to that conference, to keynote that conference, and was there probably 15 minutes and realized that every single issue that they were talking about are the very same issues that we in the US were talking about. How to get students to come in and see their personal tutor. What's the personal tutor's role? How is it not just registration? You know, how to work with students who are having academic difficulty. How to be more inclusive in how you work with students. So that the issues were the same. It didn't matter where you were, what country you were in. It still came down to that relationship between an advisor and a student. And every country is dealing with that same issue. And so it became very clear to me that NACADA needed to branch out and needed to reach out to our international partners, and not in a way of NACADA telling the rest of the world how to do advising, but so that we can learn from them what's working in those countries. And I think that the international globalization of the association, and it was under your presidency that we changed our name to the global community of academic advising, I think really has set the tone that this is an international issue and we have to work together and learn from each other. It's very, very exciting that we have our first international board member coming on in October, Oscar from the University of Maastricht in the Netherlands. I think that will go a long way to really solidify that this isn't just something we think we are, but we really are international within that. Our international conferences have created that. There's some fascinating research coming out of places like the Netherlands and the UK and China and Japan, Australia, that we would never know about, and that we're learning how to do better advising in this country because of what we have learned from other countries. And so I think it's been a really an exciting move for us, but it's also moved the profession much further than it would have had we not made this step.
I know you said NACADA right now is about 14,000 mm-hmm. members, and how many countries do you know are represented at this time, or roughly?
It varies, but somewhere between 37 and 42
That's
different
wonderful.
Countries we have members in.
What are some of the countries you visited on behalf of NACADA?
Oh gosh, been to Australia, the UK several times. We'll be going to Ireland in this July with our international conference in July, to several of the United Emirates, to Qatar, Japan, China, Canada, of course, because Canada has always been a part of the association within that. Germany, Italy.
Didn't you go to South America one time?
South America, that's right, to
Peru.
Yes. And worked with the universities in Lima and outside of the major metropolitan part of Lima within that. So,
great.
Yeah.
Talk about maybe a couple of memories from traveling internationally and that, you know, maybe special to you or just fun.
Number one, I think it's been great fun to travel with other NACADA colleagues to go. Jane Drake and I have traveled several times. Jane, a former president of NACADA and now retired from Temple University. Jane and I have been to Qatar. We've been to the Middle East, to other countries. We've been to Japan together. And so I think traveling with colleagues has been a great experience for that. I always say Jane Drake is my hero because the first trip to Japan, she took totally by herself and researched everything and was able to get from the airport to the school and to the subway and the trains. And I laughed that I literally would still be in Japan on some train going around the city if I hadn't been with Jane, because I had no idea what I was doing. And so I think that the exciting thing has been to go to campuses across the world and the interest they have in advising and in student success, and that it doesn't matter the language barrier, it doesn't matter their structure, it doesn't matter what type of institution they have, they're all interested in how do we as a profession support students and help them become more successful. I think that's probably the most exciting thing, is to recognize that it's, for years we tended to think it was just a U.S. or North American issue with Canada as well, and recognizing that it's not, that it is an international issue, and that we can learn so much from our international colleagues about what they're doing, as well as they can learn from us.
I know you've got a couple trips planned coming up, and I know one of them potentially is to China if things work out
right.
politically and those things. But what do you kind of expect might happen with some of the Chinese connections?
There's a great deal of interest about advising in China. They're really focused on the student success, and it's a country where, much like in the UK, 15 years ago, and it's not as much so now because changes that have occurred in the United Kingdom, but basically students begin college at their institution and they don't transfer. So if they're not successful there, they simply drop out and don't go to college. And they don't have an adult population. So it's not where, as in the U.S., that someone who's changing careers at 50 will go back to college to get a degree and move forward. In Asia, primarily Japan, China, Korea, Vietnam, you go at 18 or you don't go. And so because of that, they really are recognizing, number one, they have less 18-year-olds because they've done a pretty significant impact on lowering the population rate within those countries. But what that means is they have less 18-year-olds coming into the higher ed, so they've got to focus on the student success. And so in China, for example, they're really very interested in learning about the profession. And so that in addition to these opportunities of going to speak at universities, we're also working with them that they want to translate the primary, what we think of as the Nakata foundational books, the Becoming a Master Advisor, Advising Approaches, the Guidebook for New Advisors. We're working with them and Josie Bass to have those texts translated into Chinese for their advisors and for them to use. They've already begun translating the core competencies into Chinese. And we've just had those translated into Spanish so that we can begin getting those out to South America, because it's a language barrier there within that. And so I think that's going to be the exciting thing, is that we're going to start seeing material that in the past has only been available to English-speaking educators to now be available in their own languages. And so I'm really excited about that aspect.
Great. How about here in the North America? Any special memories or any stories that, you know, from Nakata that come to mind right away?
You know, I think that the most interesting piece of having worked in the executive office has been the recognition that we have very strong regional associations within the association. We have the 10 regions, but every region has its own culture and every region has its own network. And so that it's been so fascinating to go to all 10 regions and see the different cultures of the conferences. You know, Region 1 conference is very, very different than a Region 10 conference, and a Region 8 conference is very, very different than a Region 4 conference. And a lot of it has to do with just the culture of the area, the friendships that have been built within those regions, within that. So I think that's been exciting, just to be able to see those different pieces. And most Nakata members only get to see what happens in their region. And so it's been a real pleasure to be able to connect and see what's going on all across the country within that. And I think right now, it's really important that those types of connections continue and expand, as higher education in this country, as we all know, I don't know any other way to say it, but is under attack by the public, by the various political parties, that, you know, it's not providing what students need and it's too expensive and there's not a need for a college degree in liberal arts anymore and you should all be workforce development. So I think it's going to be important that we as an association really continue to focus on the value of what a higher education degree does for you. It's not just getting you a job. The whole idea of people change because they have a college degree. You know, as a first-generation student, I know that I am so different than my parents were because they were not college. They neither were them finished high school. And so that opportunity to grow in that way is something I think that advising truly has the strongest connection to. And that it's going to be through the increased in value of advising that I think we're going to deal with this attack or this negativity within that. The other side of it, everything has two sides. The other side of it, of course, is it is forcing higher education to be accountable. You know, higher education, I say in speeches a lot, you know, Johnny Can't Read came out in the 70s, and K-12 has been under attack ever since for accountability. And higher education just kind of floated along on, you know, academic freedom, and we do whatever we want to. And, you know, legislators and board of trustees at private schools and individual community college boards, you know, they're now asking the questions of, you know, we're proud of you that you have the largest freshman class, but only 50% of those are actually graduating. And so the move to funding based upon completion of graduation rates, while it totally changes how your campus has to function, I personally think is a good move because it does make us accountable. You know, in the past, you just recruited more students to replace those that left, but no one really ever asked about all of those that didn't get through. And so, you know, even gigantic campuses like Arizona State, you know, you're constantly trying to raise your retention rates and your graduation rates. So it's not just small colleges, it's massive, huge Research One universities where that was the you know, when folks my age went to college, the president would stand up at orientation and say, look to your left, look to your right, two of you won't be here next semester, and that was supposed to motivate us. And so, but the attitude clearly was that it's a, you know, we weed you out and only the top elite graduate. And we have to really recognize that really goes against anything that we as a country have talked about in terms of diversity and equity and social justice, is to recognize that many of those students who are not successful, they're not successful because of the issues that they bring with them. And advising really is the area that looks at those social justice areas, yeah, and looks at those diversity areas and helps those students who come in with that very poor background to figure out how to move forward. And I think between curricular changes and the connection with advising, we're seeing significant changes occurring in higher ed, but higher ed changes slowly.
Right.
And
right.
I think as an association, we have to continue to really be mindful and forceful in how we work with academic advisors to become much more at the table on their campuses in decision making. And we're seeing that occur.
Yes.
You know, we're starting to see that occur, where advisors are at the table when discussions are being had about things like curricular pathways, you know, instead of the faculty developing a pathway and advisors hear about it a year later and then they're supposed to be the ones to guide students through it, advisors are actually working with faculty to create those and being a part of those. And the days of faculty controlling everything on a campus and advisors not being involved in those discussions is ending on many campuses. It's not where it needs to be yet, but we're definitely making a shift in it, I think.
I agree. You know, in your analogy of look to the left, look to the right, you know, I think on most campuses today, if somebody used that in a classroom or in the environment, they'd probably lose their job because now it's every student has the right and should succeed, and we need to support all those students. So, you know, Charlie, you mentioned you are an instructor at Kansas State University in the master's of degree in academic advising and certificate. You have, well, I know that you have been a significant impact in so many people in academic advising. If somebody is in that master's program or somebody comes to you and says, I want to get started, I'm ready to go, what do I need to do to become an advisor? What advice would you give that person?
I think it's the same advice that we need to be giving students. You know, students would come in and say, I want to be a teacher. You know, have you ever actually gone and sat in a middle school classroom and seen a classroom of sixth graders for 8 hours a day? You know, I want to be a nurse. Have you ever actually dealt with people who are sick and dying and afraid? And I think it's the same thing with advisors. One of the first things I say to all of our master's students, because when we began the master's program and the graduate certificate program, the majority of the students in both of those programs were folks who were already in advising, who were getting advanced training. They were folks, in fact, the first cohort of students that we had probably was about half faculty, people who had been advising for years but never had any professional training in advising. What we're seeing now in our program are people who are coming into the field because they want to become advisors. And one of the biggest things that we talk to them about, and NACADA is working with Kansas State in developing a much stronger internship program, so that we tell our students, go to your local college, your local community college, your local university, and go to the advising office and say, you know, I'd like to intern. I'd like to spend time seeing what you do and work within that, because it's important you know what you're getting into. And it's just like with any other field. It has its great days and it has its bad days. And I think if you don't know what you're up against, you're not going to be successful. So I think that's the first thing I would tell anybody who's thinking about going into the field is, do you really know what an advisor does? Have you really sat in an advisor's seat and been a part of that? I think one of the most exciting things that I've seen occur in my time at NACADA is the number of people who are very different than you and I.
Mm-hmm.
You were in housing for many years. I was a faculty member for many years. And I kind of describe it as we fell into advising within that. We didn't choose that as a career. We fell into it. And it's exciting to see the number of students, graduate students, who are choosing the field to go into advising. About 8 years ago, Region 1 started. Rodney Mondor started it. It was a, let's just take graduate students to dinner and have a conversation. And now that's a major piece of the Region 1 conference, as we talk about different cultures of the conferences, that they have an evening in which the NACADA members from Region 1 take all the graduate students who are at the conference to dinner. And they've actually built it into their budget, and they pay for those students' dinners. And it's the opportunity for those students to talk to advisors. And this year, they did it as a reception, but it was so much fun to stand there and talk to, there was about 30 graduate students who want to be academic advisors. And that didn't exist when I came to the executive office in 2002. And so I think that's really exciting. And I think that's one of the reasons NACADA has to continue to change and grow, because we have to recognize that we've got a whole new type of advisor coming into the profession. And those are those who are choosing that, who want to make it a career. And how do we support them? And how do we get campuses to support careers for advisors? We all know that for many campuses, advising has been the place everybody on campus is stealing staff from, because they know everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And,
yes,
you know, they can pay more in this office, so I'll go work there. And so working with campuses to recognize that retention of good advisors, we've got to have career ladders. We've got to have ways to encourage research. We've got to have ways to encourage involvement in the association and in the profession. And I think that's exciting. I see that as really one of the most exciting next steps for the association, is to really be supporting these new advisors who are coming into the field because they want to make it a career and not just a job.
Sure. You know, our time is winding down here. I have a couple more questions
okay.
I'd like to ask. First of all, so you've been doing this now close to 20 years or
mm-hmm.
more than 20, 25 years at your own campus and then with the executive office. What do you think the future looks like for academic advising?
I think it's exciting. I think it has so much potential for higher education. The new research center that NACADA has just opened
mm-hmm.
is going to have huge impact on the profession. The partnership that we're working with John Gardner and his staff and his institute on with the Excellence in Academic Advising Program has such potential for that. And so that I really see and predict that within the next decade, that advising is going to be central on every campus, and that it's not going to be something that is seen as just a service, that it's going to be directly connected with the academic mission of the campus, and that advisors are going to be seen as educators and not staff who are just scheduling people. And I think that's exciting. I think the research in the field is going to be phenomenal in the next decade, because we have not just new advisors. We have advisors who have been in the field for 20 and 30 years who really want to now begin to do research and write about their experiences and their opportunities. And that's not been there before. So I think the association is going to have great impact on higher education in the future. And I think it's going to continue to grow as a profession, and I think NACADA is going to continue to grow to be hugely important, and an important association within all of higher education because of that.
So, Charlie Nutt's story, you know, you've had a long history in higher ed, a long history with NACADA. I know, you know, you are nearing the age of retirement, or desire of retirement. And so what's Charlie Nutt's story going to be after NACADA, after retiring?
You know, I joke all the time and say I'm going to sit on the beach and drink margaritas on St. Simon's Island. And I think people who know me enough know that sitting on my butt is not something I do well. Even when I'm not employed by NACADA, I will always be connected to NACADA and connected to the field and connected to higher education. I talk to my graduate students. I teach the first course that grad students take at Kansas State, History and Philosophy of Higher Education, which is just such a fascinating course within that. But I begin the first night talking about their job throughout their graduate program is to become a student of higher education. And so I think the future of Charlie Nutt will be to continue to grow as a student of higher education.
That's
and
great.
to be a part of what's happening in the field, and to be able to be very proud of where the associations come. You know, people tend to think I don't have anything before NACADA, and you know, this is hard to believe for myself, but this is my 40th year as an educator. I began teaching 9th grade and 10th grade English when I was 21 years old in 1977. And so this is my 40th year. And so I have a long history of education.
Yeah.
My dad used to always say, didn't I know that there was schools at University of Georgia that people made money at? And I just have always wanted to be a teacher. And so, you know, I see myself teaching. I would love to go back and teach freshman comp again at my community college that I graduated from in my hometown. I hope to continue teaching in the graduate program at Kansas State. And I hope to be able to have time to do some of the research and writing that I would love to be doing now but don't have the time to do within that.
Well, and I hope you also do take time for those margaritas on the beach.
Oh, don't worry.
Yes.
I will definitely take time for the beach.
Well, Charlie, it's been a pleasure to do this interview. Thank you very much for helping us promote the concept of the storytelling for the Phoenix Conference.
I'm so excited about this theme and this concept, and just really want to congratulate you and Julie Voglia, who I know have together come up with this, and I'm thrilled with this idea, and I think it's going to be very, very exciting for the Phoenix Conference.
Thank you, Charlie, very much. Yes, you will not be able to resume this interview. Yes, I'm done.